Hello, this is your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, bringing you the March 24th edition of the New Yorker magazine. Today's main story is The Battle for the Bros by Andrew Marantz. The political scene, The Battle for the Bros, Young Men Have Gone MAGA, Can the Left Win Them Back? By Andrew Marantz. By the time I landed at LAX and switched my phone out of airplane mode, Hassan Piker had been streaming for 3 hours. I put in an earbud and watched as I filed off the plane. Visible behind him were walls of framed fan art, a cardboard cutout of Bernie Sanders sitting in the cold, and Piker's huge puppy, Kaya, taking a nap. Piker had already shown off his cozy-ass fit, sweatpants with kitschy bald eagles, and a custom pair of platform Crocs, and recounted his experience the previous night at the Streamer Awards, a red carpet event honoring A-listers on Twitch, the popular live-streaming site where he is one of the biggest stars and the only prominent leftist. He's begun the day's broadcast by rattling off a standard opening monologue. Folks, we're live and alive, and I hope all the boys, girls, and NBs, non-binary people, are having a fantastic one. To anyone listening for shibboleths, this would have pigeonholed him as a progressive. And within view, though there were three towers of Zin canisters and a Make America Great Again hat, which he sometimes wears ironically. He has the patter of a Rutgers frat bro and the laid-back charisma of a Miami club promoter, both of which he was briefly in his early 20s. Now he's 33, so old in streamer years, that his fans call him Unk. I ordered a lift, then flipped back to Piker's stream. By then, he was talking about the overflow of the Assad regime in Syria, which had happened overnight. I watched as he cycled from BBC footage to Wikipedia, pausing every few seconds to add a diatribe or a joke. The angle he was developing was that Western journalists seemed too eager to portray the leader of the Syrian rebel forces in a heroic light. "I'm very skeptical of the fucking former Al-Qaeda guy," Piker said. A little while later, his doorbell rang, and he leaned over to buzz in a guest, me. I looked up from my phone to see him standing in his doorway. He doesn't run ad breaks, so whenever he needs to do something off camera, like answer the door or use the bathroom, he plays a video and attends to his business quickly before his viewers can get bored. "I'm live right now, but we can talk when I'm done," he told me, already walking away. "Try and stay out of the shot." In last year's presidential election, Democrats lost support with nearly every kind of voter, rich, white, poor, Black, Asian, American, Hispanic. But the defection that alarmed party strategists the most was that of young voters, especially young men, a group that Donald Trump lost by 15 points in 2020 and won by 14 points in 2024, a nearly 30-point swing. The only cohort of men that Biden won in 2020 was 18 to 29-year-olds, John Della Volpe, the polling director at Harvard's Institute of Politics and a former advisor to Biden's presidential campaign, told me. That was the one cohort they had to hold on to, and they let it go. Candidates matter, so does the national mood and the price of groceries. Yet some Monday morning quarterbacks also noted that just as 1960 was the first TV election and 2016 was the first social media election, the 2024 presidential campaign was the first to be conducted largely on live streams and long-form podcasts, media that happened to be thoroughly dominated by MAGA bros. The biggest of them all, Joe Rogan, spent the final weeks of the campaign giving many hours of fawning airtime to Trump and to his running mate J.D. Vance and his key allies such as Elon Musk before endorsing Trump on the eve of the election. "At no point was I, like only I, a dickhead on the internet, am qualified to teach these kids why we need a functioning welfare state," Piker told me. "I just felt like no one else was really in these spaces trying to explain these things, certainly not the Democrats." Piker has almost 3 million Twitch followers And as with most guys who talk into microphones on the internet, his audience skews young, male, and disaffected. At the peak of his election night stream in November, he had more than 300,000 viewers. He broadcasts 7 days a week, 8 to 10 hours a day, usually from his house in West Hollywood, and he doesn't use visual pyrotechnics to hold his viewers' attention. Most of the time, what you see on his stream is an overlay of three things. A fixed shot of Piker sitting at his desk, a screen share of whatever he's looking at on his computer, and his chat, where his fans supply pertinent links, caps lock shit talk, and puppy emojis, all surging in real time up the right side of the screen. Although Piker hates Trump, he's hardly a loyal Democrat. At bottom, he's an old school, hard leftist, not a liberal. On his bedside table, he has some protein Pop-Tart knockoffs and a copy of the Communist Manifesto. Many of his opinions, for example, that the American empire has been a destructive force on the whole, would surely be off-putting to the median voter. But he is just one of many independent media creators with an anti-Trump message. In recent weeks, the political podcast charts have included The Bulwark, This Is Gavin Newsom, and even a show called Raging Moderates. For a couple of weeks last month, a liberal show called The Midas Touch Podcast beat out the Joe Rogan Experience for the number one spot. Corporate media, too often, has a both sides perspective. Ben Mylesis, one of the Midas Touch co-hosts, told me, "We do not mince words about the threats to workers, the threat to democracy." One piece of fan art on Piker's wall is a cartoon of him operating a daycare center, shielding a room full of lost boys from the lying chaos of the open internet. "You gravitate to him because he's just a voice you find relatable," Piker's producer, who goes by March, told me. "A lot of people don't even put a political label on it, or at least at first." Piker gets up early every morning to work out, posting his daily stats so his fans, his community, can follow along from home. He gives dating advice and motivational speeches. At a moment when there seems to be an ever-shortening algorithmic pipeline from bench-pressing tips to misogynist rage, Piker tries to model a more capacious form of masculinity, a straight guy, 6'4", and a movie star handsome, who's as comfortable wearing camo to a gun range as he is walking a red carpet in split-toe Margiela boots. Once viewers have come to trust him, they may be more open to his riffs on the rights of the poor or of trans people, delivered not as a primer on Judith Butler, but in the register of "Bro, don't be a dick." I pulled up a chair just out of frame. Kaya ambled toward me, vetting my scent. Piker talked almost without interruption for 4 more hours, holding forth about recent internet drama, a documentary about the history of NATO, and the United Healthcare CEO's assassin, who had not yet been identified. Within reach of his rolling desk chair was a mini fridge full of cold brew and Diet Mountain Dew. Some of his takes were too unpolished for primetime. "Bro, these guys are so cocked," he said, critiquing a clip from a rival podcast on the right. Then again, live stream isn't supposed to be a tight, scripted lecture. It's supposed to be a good hang. "I gotta end the broadcast here," he said shortly after 8 p.m. "I'll see you tomorrow." After turning the camera off, he seemed to deflate a bit. Comments were still floating up on one of his monitors. The thousands of fans in the chat had dwindled to a few hundred, the inner circle who were devoted enough or lonely enough to keep one another company after the feed had gone dark. "The Democrats are smug and condescending, and everything they say sounds fake as shit," Piker said. "Trump lies constantly, yes, but at least people get the sense that he's authentically saying what he's thinking." He put his feet up and reached for a fresh Zin pouch. "Young men, like a lot of Americans, feel increasingly alienated," he continued. "They can't afford college or rent, they can't get a date, they can't imagine a stable future. The right is always there to tell them, yes, you should be angry. And the reason your life sucks is because of immigrants, or because a trans kid played a sport. And all the Democrats are telling them is, no, shut up, your life is fine, be joyful. No one has ever accused Piker of being a moderate, but in this case, he is trying to forge a compromise. My way is to go, look, be angry if you want, but your undocumented neighbor is not the problem here. You're looking in the wrong direction. In 2015, The Economist Anne Case and Angus Deaton wrote that white non-Hispanics without college degrees were experiencing an anomalous spike in mortality from opioids, alcohol, and suicide. They later called these deaths of despair. In 2016, J.D. Vance, then an anti-Trump conservative, published a memoir, Hillbilly Elegy, about the struggles of white rural families like his own. Promoting the book on PBS, he explained, but did not yet excuse, why such voters were drawn to Trump. I think that the sense of cultural alienation breeds a sense of mistrust. The first Trump administration didn't deliver many material gains to the rural poor. Deaths of despair continued to rise and wages continued to stagnate. But at least Trump spoke to their anguish and seemed outraged on their behalf. In retrospect, the question may not be why so many non-urban, non-elites became Trump Republicans, but what took them so long. Around the same time, social scientists started to notice an overlapping crisis. The statistics were grim. 21st century males were, relative to their forefathers and their female contemporaries, much more likely to fall behind in school, drop out of college, languish in the workforce, or die by overdose or suicide. The title of a 2012 book by the journalist Hannah Rosen declared The End of Men. The following year, the economists Marianne Bertrand and Jessica Pan published a paper called The Trouble with Boys. In one survey, more than a quarter of men in their teens and 20s reported having no close friends. When COVID hit, men were significantly more likely to die from it. In the 15 years I've been looking at the statistics, the outcomes for men have not changed, Rosen told me. What did change tremendously is the culture. The last Democratic presidential candidate to win the male vote was Barack Obama. When Bernie Sanders ran for president, he had a zealous male following, but many top Democrats treated the Bernie bros less like a force to be harnessed than like a threat to be vanquished. A White Dudes for Harris Zoom call raised millions for Kamala Harris's campaign, but it would have been anathema to her base if she'd given a speech about what she planned to do for white dudes. This was, meanwhile, a key part of Trump's appeal. In a 2022 book of Boys and Men, Richard Reeves, a social scientist and a fellow at the Brookings Institution, blasts Republicans for exploiting male dislocation and misogynist fury at the expense of women's rights. But he also lambasts Democrats for pathologizing masculinity. He gives an example from his son's high school in Bethesda, Maryland, where boys passed around a spreadsheet ranking their female classmates by attractiveness, behavior that Reeves describes as immature, even harmful, but not worthy of an international incident, which is what it became. He writes that indiscriminately slapping the label of toxic masculinity onto this kind of behavior is a mistake, likely to propel young men to the online manosphere, where they will be reassured that they did nothing wrong, and that liberals are out to get them. At some point between Bill Clinton playing the saxophone on the Arsenio Hall show and Hillary Clinton describing potential voters as deplorables, the Democrats came to be perceived as the party of scolds and snobs. Liberals used to be the counterculture. Today, they're the defenders of traditional norms and institutions. This may not have been the best political strategy at any time. It certainly isn't now, when trust in institutions has never been lower. It's impossible to know how many young men fit into this category, but there is clearly a kind of guy, the contemporary don't tread on me type, who demands both the freedom to have gay friends and the freedom to use gay as an insult, who resents the idea of his morality being dictated by the family values right, or his speech being curtailed by the hall monitor left. When pressed, many of these young men seem to have bought the pitch that of the two parties, the Republicans were less censorious. This may have been a miscalculation. The current Trump administration has already banished dozens of words from government websites and just last week arrested a former Columbia student for what seems to be protected speech. But you can't convince voters that they've been misinformed simply by lecturing them. The lecturing is part of the issue. Democrats got used to speaking about men as the problem, not as people with problems, Reeves told me. But of course, men do have problems, and problems become grievances when you ignore them. He knows a lot of well-connected Democrats in Washington, and for years, he has urged them to campaign on men's issues, not in a zero-sum way, certainly not taking anything away from women, but just to show boys and men, hey, you're also having a tough go of it. We see you. And the response I always got was, now is not the time. Rossin told me about a husband and wife she'd met in Alabama in 2010. The husband lost his job and the wife became the breadwinner, an arrangement he experienced as deeply shameful. She would put the check down on the kitchen table, she would sign it over to him, and he would cash it, and nobody would speak about it, Rossin said. But then, man-victim became a viable identity. As Rossin stayed in touch with the man, he started exhibiting a more mischievous expression of men's rights sensibilities, wearing a t-shirt that read, "My Cave, My Rules." This coincided with the rise of Trump, the man's victim's patron saint. He didn't offer detailed policy solutions to any of the underlying sociological problems, but again, he addressed them directly. It is a very scary time for young men in America, Trump said in 2018. Like most internet terms, manosphere is vague and protean. It has been applied to Ben Shapiro, a father of four who delivers conservative talking points in a yarmulke, and to Andrew Tate, a Bugatti-driving hustler who has been charged with human trafficking. In 2016, after a reedy Canadian professor named Jordan Peterson refused to use gender-neutral pronouns, he was taken up as a folk hero, like Galileo standing firm against the Inquisition. Peterson has almost nothing in common with, say, Dave Portney, another mascot of the brosphere, who mostly just wants to be left alone to eat pizza and drink beer by the pool. Yet they all seem to be meeting a demand in the cultural marketplace, one that could be as simple, at its root, as a dorm room poster of Marlon Brando on a motorcycle or Johnny Cash flipping off the camera. Last month, Richard Reeves was a guest on a popular podcast hosted by Theo Vaughn, a formerly apolitical comedian who recently went to Trump's inauguration. Vaughn, an infectiously affable guy with a mullet, presents himself as a curious goofball with an essentially no prior knowledge of any topic. At one point, he spoke, without much nuance, but also without apparent malice, about the plight of the white man. "I'm not speaking against any other group," he said. "I'm just saying, you can't make white males feel like they don't exist." Vaughn grew up poor in a small town in Louisiana. "Yes, I know there's privilege, but if you grew up with nothing, you don't fucking feel any privilege sometimes." If Vaughn had made his observation at a Trump rally or on X, he might have been led from just asking questions guilelessness to more overt white aggrievement. If he'd made the same point in a liberal arts seminar or on Blue Sky, he might have been shouted down. "When I got to this part of the podcast, I have to admit, my own inner hall monitor was on high alert." But Reeves, looking a bit trepidatious, tried to thread the needle, introducing some academic caveats without coming across as a scold. "The U.S. has a uniquely terrible history when it comes to slavery," he said. But he also noted that low-income white men were at a particularly high risk of suicide. "Two things can be true at once," he said. The hallmark of social media is disinhibition born of anonymity. On the internet, no one knows whether you're a dog, a Macedonian teenager, or the Pope wearing a puffer jacket. Podcasts, on the other hand, are built on parasociality. Michael Barbaro isn't your friend, but after making coffee with him in your ear 100 times, you start to feel as if he were. And then there's the world of always-on streaming, in which the temptations of parasociality are even more acute. The inputs are both oral and visual. The hosts respond to your comments in real time at all hours. You can remind yourself not to bond with the pixels on the screen, but you may fall for the illusion all the same, like a baby chick imprinting on a robot. Piker treats fans in a way that can be confusingly intimate, giving them avuncular life advice 1 minute and thirst trap photos on the next. His Twitch handle is Hasanabi, Abi being Turkish for Big Brother. His fans are called Hasanabi heads or parasocialites. Even as most of his fellow streamers have drifted to the right, Piker has remained a staunch leftist. His explanation for this is that he is from Turkey, where the idea that American economic and military power runs the world, that was like, yeah, duh. He was born in New Jersey and grew up mostly in Ankara and Istanbul, in an upper middle class family, spending summers with relatives in the U.S. and watching a lot of American TV. He speaks English with an American accent. His father, an economist, is more of a neolib, World Bank-loving type, Piker told me. We argue about it all the time, but it's non-heated. His mother, an art and architecture historian, is more aligned with his politics. The inequality is just so blatant, she told me. It was never fair, but now we have the internet. Everyone can see it. Despite Piker's brand as a brash outsider, he is, in an almost literal sense, a Nepo baby. After graduating from Rutgers in 2013, he moved to Los Angeles and got a job with his maternal uncle, Cenk Uygur, who happened to be the founder and host of The Young Turks, one of the biggest left populist talk shows on the internet. The show had a considerable footprint on YouTube, but Piker helped it adapt to punchier formats that were better suited to Facebook and Instagram. You've got to understand, I remember this was a pudgy kid, I was changing his diapers, Uygur told me. Now suddenly, he's this handsome man, he's dynamic, he's killing it in front of the camera. Piker hosted a recurring video segment called Agitprop, and picked fights with the right-wing influencers of the day, such as Tommy Lahren and Representative Dan Crenshaw. He got himself in trouble. America deserved 9/11 was not a particularly good take, even in context, but he also expanded his name recognition. In 2017, BuzzFeed dubbed him Woke Bay. Although he made some of the outlet's most popular videos, he didn't own the IP. Even when your boss is your uncle, you can still be alienated from the means of production. So in 2020, he decided to go solo on Twitch. His mother joined him in Los Angeles, and they formed a pandemic pod in a two-bedroom apartment. He was on there nonstop shouting about video games or sex advice or whatever, she told me. His fans would see me in the background cringing, and they would send me earplugs in the mail. That year, he spent 42% of his time live on camera. Not 42% of his waking hours. 42% of all the hours in the year. In a call-in segment called Chadvice, Piker coached men through the small terrors and triumphs of daily life. One 28-year-old from Finland described himself as having an Asperger's diagnosis and an abject fear of rejection. Piker, with solicitude and just enough amiable ribbing, spent half an hour talking him through the social mechanics of a first date. When Twitch first launched, it was a niche platform where bored adolescents could watch other adolescents play video games. In 2014, Amazon bought it for nearly $1 billion, an eye-popping amount, at least back then, even as mainstream analysts knew almost nothing about it. My demographic hem is showing, the columnist David Carr admitted in the Times. Still, he concluded, there is clear value in owning so much screen time of a hard-to-reach demographic of young men. One article referred to Twitch as talk radio for the extremely online. I first met Piker in February of 2020 on Boston Common while covering a rally during Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign. Most of us traveling correspondents were youngish reporters from oldish outlets, wearing blue button-downs and carrying notebooks in the back pockets of our bonobos. Piker wasn't much younger, but he dressed as if he were from another planet, in black nail polish and cargo pants, and at the time struck me as incomprehensibly wide. He carried an IRL backpack, a portable camera setup that streamers use, I learned, when they venture out into the world. Admirers in the crowd kept interrupting him and asking for photos, a nuisance that, for whatever reason, didn't afflict the rest of us. I still didn't get why viewers would hang around on his stream all day when they could get an unimpeded view of Sanders' speech on YouTube. Obviously, my demographic hem was showing. You might as well ask why a fan would watch a football game at a bar when he could concentrate better alone or read a summary of the game in tomorrow's paper. Piker's followers wanted to watch the rally through his eyes because they wanted to be his friend. In October 2020, Piker spent a couple of hours playing the group video game Among Us with some special guests, including the Congresswoman Ilhan Omar and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. They occasionally mentioned the ostensible purpose of the visit, getting out the vote, but mostly they made easygoing small talk. On election day, Piker streamed for 16 hours straight, chugging energy drinks. His mother made several on-screen cameos, delivering him plates of home-cooked food. "I wouldn't do it for this long if it wasn't for you," he told his viewers at the end of the night. "Love you, bro," a commenter typed. "See you tomorrow." After the 2024 election, Democratic strategists argued what the anti-Trump coalition needed was a Joe Rogan of the left. There once was such a person. His name was Joe Rogan. "I'm socially about as liberal as it gets," Rogan said earlier this month. He has a live and let live attitude about sex, drugs, and abortion. He is extremely open to conspiracy theories about 9/11, JFK, and Jeffrey Epstein, an inclination that was left-coded until very recently. In 2014, when Rogan was a fan of the Young Turks, Piker met him at the Hollywood Improv, and they sat and talked for 2 hours. The topics included weed, psychedelics, the state of media, and girls. Piker wrote at the time, "Top 10 coolest moments of my life." During the 2020 Democratic primary, Rogan interviewed three presidential candidates, Tulsi Gabbard, Andrew Yang, and Bernie Sanders, and concluded that Sanders was his favorite. "I believe in him," Rogan said. "He's been insanely consistent his entire life." It's hard to fathom now, but Rogan's support was then considered a liability. The Sanders campaign must reconsider this endorsement, the Human Rights Campaign wrote, citing transphobic and racist remarks from Rogan's past. In retrospect, this was the height, or perhaps the nadir, of a kind of purity test politics that was making some swing voters, including Rogan, feel less at home in the Democratic coalition. In 2022, Neil Young removed his music from Spotify to protest Rogan's vaccine skepticism. Rogan took ivermectin, which CNN mocked as a horse dewormer. "I can afford people medicine, motherfucker," Rogan told CNN's chief medical correspondent, adding that the medication had been prescribed by his doctor. "This is ridiculous." In 2016, every one of Trump's baby steps towards normalization, doing a goofy dance on Saturday Night Live, getting his hair ruffled by Jimmy Fallon, was treated as a scandal. But by 2024, anyone with access to Spotify or YouTube could find hours of flattering footage of Trump looking like a chill, approachable grandpa. While interviewing Trump at one of his golf clubs, Theo Von used his free associative style to great effect, prompting as much introspection in Trump as any interviewer has. "Von, cocaine will turn you into a damn owl, homie. Trump. And is that a good feeling?" Trump invited the Nelk Boys, prank video influencers with their own brand of hard seltzer, to eat Chick-fil-A on his private plane. He sat in a Cybertruck with the baby-faced fascist curious streamer Aiden Ross testing the stereo. "Who's, like, your top three artists?" Ross asked. "Well, we love Frank Sinatra, right?" Trump said. Ross invited him to pick a song, and Trump said, thinking that it's going to come back under proper management, picked California Dreamin'. This is the New Yorker magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Collectively, these shows reach tens of millions of potential voters. Most were presumably young men, many of them the kind of American who is both the hardest and most crucial for a campaign to reach, the kind who is not seeking out political news. Trump ended his parasocial media tour by sitting in Joe Rogan's studio in Austin for 3 hours. That's too long for anyone, even a champion of the rhetorical rope-a-dope, to go without gaffes, which was part of the point. While repeating his time-worn case that the 2020 election was rigged, Trump let out a shocking Freudian slip. "I lost by," before quickly trying to recover. "I didn't lose." Rogan laughed in his face. No one cared. On YouTube alone, the episode got more than 50 million views, and the reaction was overwhelmingly positive. Unedited, uncensored interviews should be required of all candidates, one of the top comments read. Harris tried. She appeared on a few podcasts. Club Shay Shay, whose audience is primarily black, and Caller Daddy, whose audience is mostly female. But she never made inroads with the comedy bros. The closest she got was an interview with Howard Stern, a former shock jock, who now seems wholesome, like Little Richard in the era of Little Baby. Harris's staffers tried to get her booked on Hot Ones, where YouTube show on which celebrities answer innocuous questions while eating sadistically spicy chicken wings, but even Hot Ones turned her down. Her campaign staffers insisted that she wanted to do Rogan's show, but it fell through for scheduling reasons. Rogan claimed he was eager to interview her, and that he was even willing to keep certain topics off limits. I said, "I don't give a fuck," he told Theo Von. "I feel like it. If you give someone a couple of hours and you start talking about anything, I'm going to see the pattern of the way they think, whether you're calculated or whether you're just free." I imagine the set of prototypical Man Cave podcast and Flagrant, co-founded by the comedian Andrew Schultz, wouldn't be far off. Four dudes lounging around with a few plastic plants and a shelf of brown liquor behind them. Trump sat with them in October, and Schultz and the other hosts buttered him up, asking him about his kids. "Barron is 18, Schultz said. "He's unleashed in New York City. Are you sure you want to reverse Roe versus Wade now?" An hour in, they cut to an ad break. "Hard dick season is upon us, and you got to make sure that you're stiffed up," Schultz said. "Blue Chew has got your back." Flagrant is taped weekly at a studio in Soho. I visited one Wednesday in February. Schultz arrived just after noon, opened a fridge stocked with cans of tequila and THC-infused seltzer, and grabbed a bottle of water. He sports a mustache and a chain necklace, and his hair is tight on the sides and slicked back on top. During a show at Madison Square Garden, a fellow comedian described Schultz's look as the to-be version of Adolf Hitler. He's a throwback to an old New York archetype, the melting pot white guy who tells hyper-specific ethnic jokes with a sly smile and, for the most part, gets away with it. He did a crowd work special that included sections called Mexican, Colombian, and Black Women. His newest special about his wife's experience with IVF includes moments of real tenderness, but he still insists on his right to do old-fashioned bits about the battle between the sexes. "We all have feelings that are a little bit wrong," Schultz said. "Take my wife, please. That's a fucked up premise. But there's a seed of feeling there that's real. It's the comedian's job to make you feel comfortable enough to laugh at it." Schultz grew up in Lower Manhattan, where his parents owned a dance studio and he went to public school. "My family was super liberal," he told me. "This was in the 90s when being a liberal to me just meant I don't hate gay people or black people. Normal shit." He now thinks of himself as apolitical, and he acknowledged all the reasons to distrust Trump, but the word he kept using whenever Trump came up was enticing. "I still appreciate a lot of the policies Bernie talked about, universal health care and all that," he said. "But culture-wise, vibe-wise, when all you hear from one side is, that's not funny, that's over the line, realistically, where are people going to feel more comfortable? Trump is known for his bloviating, but Schultz suggested that his greater talent may be a kind of listening. Democrats are tuned into what people should feel, he said. Trump is tuned into what people actually fucking feel. Schultz noted that as a boundary-pushing performer, this was also one of his own key skills, gauging micro-fluctuations in an audience's reaction. When Trump appeared on Flagrant, he talked about being taken to a hospital in rural Pennsylvania after he was shot, and how impressed he was with the country doctors who treated him. I laughed at that, because I just thought country doctors was a funny phrase, Schultz told me. He clocked me laughing at it, and the next sentence he immediately said it again, and he watches me to make sure I laugh again. Flagrant bills itself as the greatest hang in the universe. I spent the rest of the day watching Schultz and his co-hosts tape an episode, and then an extra segment sponsored by an online betting platform, and then an extra segment for Patron. And I could imagine some places in the universe that would have been greater. One of the running gags in the episode was that the host kept pronouncing the word pre-recorded as pre-retarded. At one point, a host volunteered how many times he'd masturbated in a single day, and his record was so formidable that the others looked worried for him. In fairness, though, even a solid hang can't be scintillating all the time. One function of a long-standing friendship, including a parasocial one, is simply to while away the hours, even when there isn't much to say. When it comes to parasocial media, MAGA has had a long head start. Before Dan Bongiano was Trump's deputy FBI director, he was a popular, blustery podcaster. After Matt Gaetz withdrew from consideration as attorney general, he announced that he would host a TV show and a podcast, his third. During the Biden administration, about a dozen Republicans were both active podcast hosts and sitting members of Congress, while most Democrats hardly seemed interested in trying. Before the Flagrant taping, Schultz and I had been discussing which qualities the Democrats should look for in their next crop of leaders, and afterwards he returned to the question. They need someone who can really hang, he said. Obama could hang. Clinton for sure. Bill, not Hillary. Trump can hang. I read through the short list. Pete Buttigieg. Schultz wrinkled his nose. Too polished. AOC. When she's being the working class chick from the Bronx, I could see it, he said. But when she starts going on MSNBC and doing we have an orange rapist in the White House, then you start to lose people. Schultz said that he'd invited Kamala Harris and Tim Walz to appear on the show numerous times to no avail. The Harris campaign says the Schultz never sent a formal invitation. He couldn't be sure why Walz had stayed away from podcasts like his, but he had guesses. If we've got on a guy who was in the military for 20 years, at some point I'm gonna go. Cut the shit, Tim. You know how guys really talk, Schultz said. And then let's say we start busting balls, making gay jokes, whatever. Does he laugh? If he does, he pisses off his people. If he doesn't, he loses our people. Walz was added to the presidential ticket because he was able to talk like a regular person who could make the opposition seem weird by contrast. But things being as they are, Schultz said, the Democrats can't let a guy like that loose. When Trump was on Flagrant, Akash Singh, a co-host who refers to himself as a moderate, encouraged him to consider practicing self-restraint. What we love about you as comedians is you shoot from the hip, Singh said. If you get elected, would you be a little more mindful of how powerful your words are? I will, Trump said. And I'm going to think of you every time. Let's go, Singh said, jumping up and pumping his fist. I might actually vote. Piker starts streaming at 11 every morning, so everything else has to happen before then or at night. At 7 a.m. one day, he drove Kaya to a nearby park to take her for a walk, then played basketball for half an hour. He saw me eyeing his car, a Porsche Taycan. "It's not the flashiest model I can afford," he protested before I could say anything. "But yes, admittedly, it is a fucking Porsche." When Piker is criticized by the right, it's usually for soft-pedaling the brutality of Hamas, or the Houthis, or the Chinese Communist Party. Piker is such a relentless critic of Israel that last year the advocacy group Stop Anti-Semitism nominated him for Anti-Semite of the Year. When asked his opinion of Hezbollah, he once shrugged and replied, "I don't have an issue with them." By the left, he is more likely to be dismissed as a limousine socialist who lives in a $2.7 million house. He has his own clothing brand called Ideologue. When driving home, he took a call from his manager. A major production company wanted to discuss a potential TV show, hosted by Piker in the vein of Borat or Nathan For You. His manager asked if he wanted to be interviewed by Megyn Kelly on her radio show. No. A daytime show on Fox News. No. Buttigieg's people had asked if Piker would interview Buttigieg on his stream. "Probably not, but I'll think about it," Piker said, too centrist. If he's thinking about running for president, I don't really want to be giving him clout. In his kitchen, he took a few fistfuls of supplements, creatine, fish oil, ashwagandha. Still on the phone with his manager, he sat at his desktop, skimming stories he might cover. Then a few minutes before he went live, he started seeing news alerts. Luigi Mangione, the suspect in the United Healthcare assassination, had just been arrested. Whatever else he'd been planning to talk about was now irrelevant. "Holy shit, they got him," Piker told his manager. "I gotta go." "Mamma mia," he said on air. "This is the first day where there will be no Italiophobia on this broadcast." Already, his chat was full of spaghetti emojis and free Luigi. Piker walked a fine line, celebrating Maggioni as hotter than me and speaking in generally exalted terms about the propaganda of the deed, but trying to stop short of overtly glorifying murder, which is against Twitch's terms of service. "We, of course, do not condone," he said repeatedly. "We condemn." Recently, he was suspended from Twitch for 24 hours after musing that someone might want to kill Rick Scott, the Florida senator. In fact, he reserved his condemnation for the finger-wagging for the corporate media as exhibited everywhere from Fox News to CNN. "Bro, they can't let anybody have anything," he said later. For 6 hours straight, his chatters sent him links to new information as it emerged, Maggioni's Goodreads account, his Twitter history, his high school valedictorian speech. On my own, I would have been tempted to spend the day following the same breadcrumbs, struggling to retrace Maggioni's path to radicalization. But it was easier to let Piker and the 40,000 internet sleuths in his chat make sense of it for me. Many of Piker's views come to him in inchoate opinions. He aims to mold them. But he told me of the stream, at the end of the day, it still has to be relatable and entertaining. One of his maxims is, read the room. In his case, this means posting many hours of content about nothing in particular. Stavros Halkias, a comedian a friend of Piker's, told me, he's built up enough trust with his audience that if he's being boring and academic for 40 minutes, they'll stick with it until he starts doing something more interesting, playing a Japanese dating simulator or whatever. Some days he puts on a Trump hat and streams as Hank Pecker, a Colbert Report-style satirical character updated for the MAGA era. In another room of his house, Piker records a weekly podcast with three buddies, an apolitical chat show on which one of the most heated topics of recent debate was proper manscaping technique, and another was whether one of them farted. March, the producer, was proud to tell me that the podcast audience is about 60% male, which sounds like a lot, but actually most shows in this space are 80-20 male, or 85-15. One theory for this lopsidedness is that given all the end-of-men statistics, women have better things to do with their time, such as holding down meaningful jobs and cultivating lasting relationships, while men are stuck playing video games with their imaginary friends. Recently on a MAGA Bro podcast, Piker reached across the aisle, adapting 8 hours for what you will to the current decadent moment. Deep down inside, most people just want to be comfortable, he said. They want to have a roof over their heads, they want a fucking nice meal, get some pussy, play Marvel Rivals. In recent years, Piker has stopped using the word retarded, but he still uses the word pussy, even though it may sound misogynist and lame, despite fans who consider the term ableist. I don't give a shit, Piker said. If you can't handle it, then I guess I'm not for you. When his commenters try to tone police him, Piker will often single one of them out and say, "Congratulations, Chatter, you've won Woke of the Day." It's not a compliment. The day after Maggioni's arrest, Piker had back-to-back interviews with Lena Khan, then the chair of the Federal Trade Commission, whom Piker called the LeBron James of regulators, and with the writer Ta-Nehisi Coates promoting his new book. In the chat, a user named PappyJohn36 wrote, "Not to be parasocial, but I love this man." Piker's mother stopped by during the Coates interview. "Hassan, check your messages," she shouted from the kitchen. Piker grudgingly but dutifully read his mother's message aloud. "I got his book for the content and fell in love with his writing." "Thank you, Hassan's mom," Coates said in the living room. Piker's father was sprawled on the couch watching Love Actually. Halkias, the comedian, showed up later that afternoon with a bag of dirty laundry and a calendar featuring photos of himself posing in the nude. While many of Halkias's comedian friends have taken a reactionary turn, he has stuck by his progressive principles, but he has never been a hall monitor. He got his start in a podcast called Come Town. "Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and NBs," Piker said. "We've got the left's Joe Rogan here in the building." In the Rogan of the Left discourse, both Piker and Halkias are frequently mentioned as top prospects. Even if they were secretly flattered by the designation, the least alpha thing they could do, the least Rogan-esque thing they could do, would be to thirst for it. "Free Luigi," Halkias said, taking a seat. "He's too sexy to be behind bars." As a model for the future of progressive media, Piker checks only some of the requisite boxes. A while back, he was a guest on Flagrant. When I asked about one of the show's staffers about Piker's performance, he gave it a middling review. "Good guy, clearly knows his shit, but he sort of comes off like he thinks that he's the smartest guy in the room." Piker sometimes succumbs to the socialist bro's cardinal sin of pedantry, and he can seem like a jejune know-it-all trying to reduce any societal problem to a one-word culprit, usually capitalism or imperialism. Some segments of the Democratic coalition would find Piker to be edgy or crass or even despicable. But if Rogan of the Left is to mean anything, it would surely mean a higher tolerance for controversy, even at the risk of alienating parts of the base. On the scale of whether you're calculated or whether you're just free, Piker is freer than most Democratic surrogates, Ivy League overachievers who sound like chatbots trained on stacks of campaign brochures. But he is less free than the average MAGA bro, who is unconstrained by the need for any consistent ideology. "He's funny, but not that funny," Halkias told me. "You can tell him I said that." Halkias has his own podcast, on which he gives advice to callers. On the normier parts of the spectrum are liberal influencers like Dean Withers and Harry Sisson, who have transferred the debate me bro spirit of earlier YouTube to TikTok Live. One afternoon in LA, I visited the office of Crooked Media, which was decorated with some Yes We Can iconography and had glass-walled conference rooms with cheeky names such as Sedition and Conspiracy. When the company began in 2017, its three founders, former Obama staffers named John Lovett, Tommy Viador, and John Favreau, were treated as audacious upstarts challenging the media hierarchy. Now they are middle-aged bosses in Henleys and tapered jeans. We sat in legitimate political discourse. A long table had been laid with LaCroix and popcorners. "We have become the out-of-touch lib establishment," Viator said. Lovett added, "My, how time flies." Crooked now has more than a dozen podcasts, including its flagship show, Pod Save America. Theodore recounted a time a few years back when a friend invited him to appear on a show put out by Barstool Sports, a bro-y podcast network that leans right. Theodore, worried about guilt by association, turned it down. Looking back, that was so stupid, he said. The how dare you platform someone you disagree with era is over. Fuck that. He has since appeared on the show. In 2018, Favreau was hosting a show called The Wilderness about how the Democratic Party lost its way and wanted to include a clip of Obama reaching out to the white working class. A younger producer listened and went, "I'm not sure this plays well today," Favreau said. And I went, "That's part of the problem." After the 2024 election, Piker appeared on Pod Save America. Levitt got pushback from moderate fans who objected to Piker's anti-Zionism and from progressive fans who objected to Levitt's next interview with a Democrat who wants restrictions on trans women in sports, but he shrugged it off. "It's a big tent," Levitt said. "It's got Dick Cheney in it. It's got Hassan Piker in it." The Rogan of the left formulation isn't entirely vacuous, but it's easy to misinterpret. Rogan-like figures can't be engineered. They have to develop organically. Their value lies in their idiosyncrasies, their passionate insistence on talking about chimps and ancient pyramids, say, rather than the budget ceiling, and their authenticity, which entails an aversion to memorizing talking points. Many Democrats assume that what they have is a messaging problem, that voters don't have a clear enough sense of what the Democrats are really like. But it's possible that the problem is the opposite, that many swing voters, including Joe Rogan, got a sense of what the Democrats were like, then ran in the opposite direction. The good news for Democrats is that the right does not have a monopoly on relatability. A week before his interview with Trump, Theo Von conducted an interview with Bernie Sanders while wearing a Grateful Dead shirt. "You ever see the Grateful Dead?" Von said as an icebreaker. Sanders, apparently unfamiliar with the concept, frowned and said, no. From any other politician, this would have been malpractice, but with Sanders, the crankiness is part of the crossover charm. He literally just talks common sense, one of the top YouTube commenters read. A few months later, Rogan interviewed Senator John Fetterman. "Trump is not polished, but you get a sense of who he is as a human being," Rogan said. Fetterman agreed, alluding to a line from Scarface, "All I have in this world is my balls and my word." Reeves, the social scientist, told me, "There is a strong correlation between which Democratic lawmakers are in my inbox and which ones have the year 2028 circled on their calendar." Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut read Reeves' book in 2023 and praised it on X. Many of Murphy's constituents, including his 14-year-old son, took issues with his post. Nevertheless, he persisted, writing a follow-up on Substack. "We should all try to do two things at once, fight for the equality of women and gay people, while also trying hard to figure out why so many boys are struggling and why so many people are feeling shitty." Sanders and Fetterman share what could be described as populist instincts, but ideologically they are leagues apart. On the level of pure effect, though, they may represent elements of a style that other politicians could crib from. "Personally, I find the performance of masculinity to be totally boring," Hannah Rosen told me. "But if that's what 51% of Americans need, someone who reads as some version of gruff, manly dude, but whose heart is still in the right place, then I'm willing to go along with it." Twitch stars often appear on one another's streams hoping to pick up some new fans. One afternoon, Piker headed to Zoo Culture, a gym in Encino owned by a streamer and fitness influencer named Bradley Martin, to do a collab. It would also feature Jason Nguyen, a 20-year-old Twitch star from Texas who goes by Jason the Ween. "Bradley's a big Trump guy, and we talk politics sometimes, but mostly we just talk about gym bro shit," Piker told me. "Jason probably leans Trump if I had to guess, but his content isn't really political at all." I don't lean toward anyone when reached for comment. I don't want anything to do with politics, crying face. By the time we got to the gym, Wynn was already there, performing for the camera by flirting with a woman on a weight bench. Is Jason rizzing right now, Piker? Asked Martin, who nodded. Is it working? Piker asked the woman. She replied, a little bit. Before she left, she gave Wynn her Discord handle. Bradley, I've got something for you, Piker said, removing his long-sleeve shirt. Underneath, he was wearing a tank top with a Rambo-style cartoon of Trump and the words, Let's go, Brandon. I was coming into hostile territory, so I had to fit in, Piker said. It's perfect, Martin said. Martin, who is 6'3" and 260 pounds, looks vaguely like Bradley Cooper on steroids. Martin has taken testosterone supplements, which Piker once brought up in a jocular debate about trans rights. You do hormone replacement therapy, so why can't they? Wynn is much smaller. My chat just said, there's three muscle heads in the gym right now, Wynn joked, not even pretending to look at his phone. Piker roasted Wynn with a fake comment from his own chat. Jason looks like a twink. They wandered from station to station, first bench pressing, then deadlifting as their cameraman followed. We're just here to have fun, Piker said, then dropping into a mock PSA voice. And also reach out to the young men out there who are lost, who feel anchorless, rudderless, by lifting some heavy weights. And that's all we have time for today. By Andrew Marantz. Andrew Marantz is a staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of Antisocial, Online Extremists, Techno-Utopians, and the Hijacking of the American Conversation. We are at the conclusion of this week's The New Yorker magazine program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Thank you for tuning in this week, and I invite you to join me next week for another new edition of The New Yorker magazine. Have a great week and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.